Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and reach us through www.restaurantguysradio.com. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
Happy after Father's Day,
Thank you very much. It was quite the day. Yeah, Father's Day is a fun day.
First Father's Day with four kids for you?
It was indeed my first Father's Day with four kids.
I think that's pretty great. I had a Father's Day, no kids, but I was at my father's, and it was really great.
Father's Day is a really screwed up holiday. You know that?
I didn't. Okay, why's that?
Well, it's have you figured out? Well, you're not a dad or a mom for that matter.
Not that I know of.
The incongruity of Father's Day and Mother's Day.
Yeah.
Mother's Day, we get up, we go with the kids, we get mom breakfast in bed, we put a little rose on her plate and bring her breakfast in bed, right?
Yeah.
Then we get the kids ready and we all go out for Sunday brunch somewhere.
Yeah.
And we go out to a nice restaurant.
Is this going somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Father's Day, we get up and dad gets ready to have 20 people over.
Uh-huh.
And he cooks all day.
Yeah. See, but you're in the restaurant business, though. See, that's the problem. You like
that
cooking.
Doesn't seem fair.
No, see, but most guys don't ever cook, so you do what is the opposite of what you normally do. So, you know, it's grilling. It's you build a big fire. It makes you feel like a man. All your kids are impressed. Everybody, you know.
But I don't get it. Mothers get the day off for Mother's Day, and fathers have to work.
No, it's not. Mothers get the day off from cooking, which is the drudgery that they normally have to do every day while you're out gallivanting. And on Father's Day, you get to play with the grill. What's the big deal? You know what? And your wife makes the patties, and your wife cleans up, and your wife does everything. You're like, hey, I cooked everything.
That's not how it works in my house, mister.
Well, it's how it works.
My wife does everything else, but I make the patties.
I don't think it's incongruous at all. Do you have any good food?
Doesn't seem like a fair holiday.
And it's also the time of year that it happens. I think the barbecue is great. We had some really good food. Mm-hmm. It was just hamburgers and hot dogs.
My brother lives very close to Costco.
Uh-huh.
So frequently his wife will get the meat from there and some stuff from there. And actually not a bad butcher shop at Costco. Surprising, especially the lamb, I think, they do a good job with. But, you know, I had some okay.
I disagree. I'd like to say, nah. Sorry.
Had some okay food from the grill because it wasn't funny.
All right.
Okay, because it really, really, really wasn't funny.
So you had some good food.
Had some okay food. I'm not going to say good food, but I had some okay food. I broke my rule of bringing burgers to every grilling party I go to.
Uh-huh.
BYOB, bring mm-hmm. your own burgers.
Uh-huh.
But so we had some good meat. But Costco has this really, really tasty, very sweet, super sugary chocolate cake. It's like a 5-layer cake. The cake weighs 7 pounds.
Dear Lord,
Francis. It's a 7-pound cake, but it's really rich, really chocolatey, and, you know, for an everyday chocolate cake, best supermarket cake I've ever had.
And I think so many supermarket cakes are so abominable.
Yes, I agree.
Entenmann's stuff is so abominable.
I agree. It's a little sweet. I have to say that the sugar's turned up a little bit too much, and it could be the chocolate could be a little bit darker for my taste, but you definitely get a chocolate high from this cake.
Well, and that's what we are looking for. We went with ice cream cake, but I will tell you, one of the nice things about the summer is the foods of summer, I think, are really great. And we did, you know, we are now eating, for those of you out in listening land, we are now eating strawberries from Indike Farms.
Yeah.
From Ben Kanapaki's
farm. Nice little breakfast, I got to tell you, these strawberries.
In Monroe, we are food nuts, and we have a bucket of strawberries here, which will keep us from making our normal run to the vending machine to get M&Ms. We're having, what kind of strawberries are these?
These are Early Glows.
Early Glow strawberries.
But the Early Glows are just about done. We're moving into the Winonas and the All Stars.
And this weekend, maybe the last.
Selects.
This may be the last weekend for Jersey
Strawberries. Yeah, that's what Ben said. He's going to be on the show tomorrow, and he's going to tell us where we stand as far as the strawberries go for the year.
I had some strawberries over the weekend. We had some strawberries, and we put out champagne.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that there's this sort of myth out there that strawberries and champagne go well together. And while that can be true, and I think in the summertime when you're outside, you're having a nice brunch, whatever, strawberries and champagne can go well together, but most champagnes don't go well with strawberries because we drink mostly dry champagne, right? But a slightly sweet champagne is the champagne that goes well with strawberries. And you don't need to have that for dessert. That's a great way through the summer to start out a party when you have people over.
Mm-hmm.
And the different levels of sweetness in champagne are demi-sec is the word you're looking for. And you don't find very many demi-secs available in America.
Which the translation means half dry, and I think a lot of Americans, we expect that to be pretty dry as a champagne.
But in the world of champagnes, demi-sec means sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly sweet. A little bit of sugar.
Sweet. Definitely.
Because the words brut would be a drier champagne than demi-sec.
Brut, sec, demi-sec.
Right. So when you see the words demi-sec, that is a great way. It's just a little bit of sweetness. And Americans always say, you know, I want a dry wine. I'd like to have a dry wine.
Right.
But they don't. They're
right.
lying.
You don't always want a dry wine. Sometimes you want something with a little sweetness.
It seems like a fashionable thing to say I want a dry wine. But to start with a little bit of sweetness is really great. Out there, there aren't a lot of demi-sec champagnes.
Mm-hmm.
You can find, if you ask your local retailer to order it, they'll get it for you, and some places will have it. Veuve Clicquot is a large house that makes a demi-sec champagne.
One of the things they do, too, they make them in half bottles. They're widely available in half bottles, which is nice for just, you know, everybody. Four people want a little half glass of demi-sec champagne.
I like a whole glass. And also, but if you're going to do that strawberries and champagne thing, do it with a demi-sec champagne,
right.
I find. And there's also, I mean, if you want to be a geek and go look for the some really good stuff.
And you do want to be a geek, don't you, Francis?
Whether I want to or not, it's my lot in life. There's a champagne out there by a producer called Margain, M-A-R-G-A-I-N, and they have a demi-sec out there that's available in some fine wine shops. But I encourage the strawberries and champagne thing with the demi-sec. And the other thing I want to encourage people to look for, and we're going to do a show on this, is rosé wines, dry rosé wines.
Mm-hmm. Great summer wines.
Both from France and American. Rosé wines sort of have a bad rap because...
because of White Zinfandel. Everybody thinks of sickly, syrupy, sweet wines.
Well, and a lot of people like White Zinfandel, but White Zinfandel is sort of a different matter. It's not a quality rosé wine. It's,
there are a couple of quality rosés out there made from White Zinfandel.
But very, very,
very few.
But you know, your average White Zinfandel is... just sort of a sweet beverage that's sort of okay. But there are some really good rosé wines, and summertime is the time to drink them. Later on, go ahead.
Can I tell you how spoiled I am?
How spoiled are you?
We're sitting here eating these strawberries, and they are spectacular. They really are spectacular. Mm-hmm. But I'm sitting here going, yeah, these were picked on Saturday.
Too old.
I want the ones that were picked this morning.
It's funny. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking with a friend of ours, a guy named Sam Gugino. Sam Gugino is a columnist. He's a food columnist for Wine Spectator magazine and many other publications. He has his own website, and he has written what I find to be maybe the best article on coffee, where it comes from, how it's grown, how to make it, and all the implications of it. And I thought it was so great, so I asked him to come on the show to talk with us about it, and he's going to do that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:15.
Here we go.
Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're here going to be talking about coffee with one of our favorite food journalists and a very interesting, well-read, scholarly fellow. Sam Gugino is a food columnist for Wine Spectator magazine, a contributor to Cigar Aficionado and Women's Day, as well as the New York Times. He's been nominated for a James Beard Journalism Award. He's author of the books Cooking to Beat the Clock, Eat Fresh, Stay Healthy. And now he publishes the fabulous foodie newsletter and runs the website samcooks.com, where we're going to put a link up on our site later on, and you should all visit. Hello, Sam.
Welcome to the show, Sam.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You, as I mentioned earlier, blew me away with that article on coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I don't take this the wrong way. You're welcome. Don't take this the wrong way, but you're kind of a nut, Sam.
More of a bean,
just,
I think, Sam.
Funny. Yeah. Just so everyone knows, there's this article on coffee, which you can currently get at samcooks.com. And it's a fabulous article talking about where coffee comes from, the history of coffee regions around the world, and right down to how to brew the perfect pot of coffee, where to get coffee, and what kind of machines to use. Now, when most people write an article about coffee, they do a little research from their computer, from their library, they make some calls. You go to Central America.
They may even taste some coffee.
Yeah. You go to Central America and visit the fincas.
That's right, which is a coffee estate,
which
for
is
those of us who don't know terminology.
There you are. Actually, and so whatever prompted, did you have this, was this like a long in the planning, this article on coffee? How does this come about?
Well, actually, it was originally done for Wine Spectator magazine.
Uh-huh.
And they were the ones that sent me down there. And I said, if I'm going to do this story, it's, you know, because this major opus on coffee, I have to go where the coffee is grown. And they agreed to do that. And I went down there with the Dallas coffee people. Do you know the Dallas coffee people in New York? It used to be called Dallas Brothers. Now it's just called Dallas. And David Dallas and Jim Munson, who regularly go down there to visit their clients, took me. And we spent some time in Costa Rica and in Nicaragua.
So I can see why you would be nominated for a James Beard Award in journalism, because you really go right to the source of things, quite literally. What kind of things do you find that you – because this article is great, and we're going to put a link up to it on the website, and I'm going to send people there. And I want to talk about the meat of the matter in a moment. But, you know, what kind of things do you think that you found out by actually going there that you couldn't have found out by researching in books and making telephone calls and things like that?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and I think the most important thing for people to know about coffee, is that it's a very labor-intensive product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If people knew what goes into the making of coffee, they would be much more willing to spend a little bit extra for the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Because it's more intensive than wine. It mm-hmm. it takes and the reason it doesn't cost as much as wine probably is because it's grown in poor areas usually, and mm-hmm.
The labor costs are
a little bit lower. But, I mean, from the growing and the picking and the processing and the roasting, it's just a multi-step process that is fascinating.
Right. Well, just like in the best grapes grow in mountain regions, the best coffee beans grow in mountain regions.
Right. It's interesting. Coffee is interesting in that it grows in equatorial areas,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't like hot weather.
Right.
It likes altitude, and so the best beans grow at high altitudes. When you hear the talk about mountain-grown coffees, even though the people talk about are Mrs. Folger.
Right. Mountain-grown.
Yeah.
Mrs. Folger's never even been up on that mountain.
Yeah, those crystals really didn't do anything, did they, Sam? Folger's crystals.
Mount Tam, maybe, in San Francisco. But anyway, the best beans, that they call hard beans, or high mountain beans are grown in high altitude to up to 5,000 feet, and in places like Kenya and Guatemala and so forth. So,
well, Sam, we can't go too in depth, but a lot of our readers who haven't read your article, I would love to just give them the Reader's Digest version of all the different processes that go into making coffee, because we probably don't realize exactly where mm-hmm. coffee comes from, that it comes from a berry and all the different things that have to happen to it before it winds up in our pot. Can you give us the Reader's Digest version of that?
Sure. The coffee comes from, it's actually the pit of a fruit, which they refer to as a cherry, the coffee cherry. Mm-hmm. And it actually has a kind of a cherry-like taste to it. And the bush looks kind of like a bush, looks bright green leaves. And the fruit is about the size and shape of a large cranberry.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting about the fruit is that the fruit can be at all levels of ripeness on the same tree.
Right.
So you've got it's like picking grapes in Sauternes. You got to keep going back over and over and over again.
Right, because you pick only the ripe ones and pick a berry at a time and then come back and do it again and then again and again.
Right, you sometimes go through 11, 12, 13 times, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And these things are almost always picked by hand because, A, you've got to get the ripe berries, and, B, they're almost always on slopes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost impossible to pick them by machine.
So what do we do when we get the berries?
You get the berries, you bring them to a processing. There are two processing areas. One's a wet processing and one is a dry processing. The wet processing, or beneficio as it's called, just removes the pulp, allows the pits or the beans to ferment for about 24 hours, and then washes them down this channel. And this is all done by hand, although the pits are removed by machine.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's washed and sent to a dry processing plant. And the dry processing can take a day, or it can take 2 to 3 weeks, depending on whether you do it by machine or by hand.
Uh-huh.
And you want to dry it so that you can remove the parchment on the outside.
Right.
And then
that's the coating on the bean.
These beans are tested in the dry processing plant. And then they're shipped as green beans. They're not roasted there.
Right.
They're shipped as what they're called green. They're sort of a bluish green.
Right.
To whoever wants to buy them. And then they are typically roasted at the place where they are sold. So
right,
if somebody
right.
in the United States buys a green bean, he'll buy Costa Rican or Nicaraguan beans or blend them
right.
together
and
then
we
roast them.
When we talk about fresh roasted beans, we're talking about a bean that's been roasted fresh, not necessarily a bean that's been picked fresh.
Those green beans can actually last up to a year. I actually did a follow-up story on home roasting.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Sam, can we talk about that in just a moment? We have
sure.
to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Sam Gugino about coffee. Sam has written the best article on coffee I've ever read, and he's actually visited the coffee plantations, and we're going to talk with him more about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, time is 11:25.
Welcome back. You're listening to Mark Pascal and Francis Schott, The Restaurant Guys. Today we're talking with Sam Gugino, a food columnist for Wine Spectator, as well as many other publications. Sam, we were just talking about roasting coffee and green coffee beans. Why don't you finish your thought?
Well, I was saying that I also did a column on home roasting, which is kind of an interesting thing. And it really is, you can actually buy green beans, and they're now sold on a lot of sites on the Internet.
Right.
And buy them, and then roast them as you want them.
Yeah, so, and I read that article. Some of those coffee makers are pretty reasonable.
Yeah, you can buy a decent one for $150.
Do you find, you know, it's funny, we run a restaurant here in Central Jersey, Sam, and we have a roaster, and we have a custom blend of coffee that we worked for a long, long time for him to make for us. Mm-hmm. And one of the criteria that we had for choosing him, for 13 years we were making this blend of coffee just for us, is he roasts two or three times a week. Mm-hmm. So we're always fresh roasted. Is it, I mean, do you think it's wise for people, the best way to get coffee is to roast it at home, or do you think that there's an advantage to using someone who does it professionally?
To be honest, I didn't notice a huge difference or much of a difference at all between the stuff I roasted at home and the stuff I got from a good coffee roaster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of that may be that it takes a while to get up to speed to become a good roaster on your own. Part of it may be the quality of the beans that are purchased. You see,
right.
I realize it's just... You know, maybe the beans that the really good coffee roaster is getting are just better quality to
right.
begin with. My feeling is if you buy from a good local roaster or from an online roaster, because when you buy mail order coffee, typically it's roasted the day that it's mailed.
Right.
So although it seems counterintuitive, mail order coffee is often fresher than
I was going to say, that's going to be fresher than anything you could buy in a store.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the freshness of when the coffee is roasted and when the coffee is ground is so important. But as far as the level to which coffee is roasted, we know that some coffee is roasted further, darker roast, and some is a lighter roast. What are your feelings on how heavy coffee should be roasted, and is Starbucks coffee really burnt like everybody says?
Frankly, I think Starbucks coffee is burnt, or it tastes burnt, and I don't know if that means something about the quality of the beans, or that they have to roast them so fast because they sell so much coffee.
Yeah,
we should all be making a gazillion pounds of coffee a day. You
don't have time
through.
To linger.
Yeah. To contrast that with a place like Pete's, which is a Bay Area, California-based company that roasts darkly, as dark or darker than Starbucks, which does not taste burnt. So. It depends on what you're using it for. If you want an espresso, you want a darker roast. If you want a morning cup of coffee that you put in a Mr. Coffee type machine or a press pot, you're going to want something that's more medium roasted. I have gotten away from darker roasts and heavier roasts as I've gotten older to more medium full city roasts, and with some acidity in it to give a little bit more snap. Than the heavier, syrupy type coffees like the Sumatrans.
Sam, we're going to put Pete's Pete's website up. We're going to link them to our website as well. And we're
another,
also going
another great coffee house.
And we're also going to encourage everyone to visit samcooks.com, where you can find more. Sam knows more than just about coffee. That's just a topic of the day, and we could spend a week talking with Sam about coffee. And when we come back after the news, we're going to be talking more about where you can get great coffee, how you can make great coffee at home, and some of the political ramifications of buying coffee, because we have a lot of issues to consider in that regard. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
C Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 to noon or just through restaurantguysradio.com. Today, we're speaking with food columnist for the Wine Spectator magazine, also a contributor to Cigar Aficionado and Women's Day, as well as The Times, Sam Gugino. Sam, in the article I just read that you wrote about coffee, which is what we're the main topic of today's show, coffee, you wrote that coffee has 1,500 different flavor profiles. What makes a great coffee great?
Well, part of it has to do with getting the best beans. You know, it's very much like winemaking. Mm-hmm. You need the best raw materials, and that very often means getting it from an estate that is takes good care of its trees, its coffee plants. More and more we are seeing in coffee what we're seeing in wine, and that is estate-grown coffee. And that is coffee that comes from a specific place.
From one single vineyard or one single
right,
place, yeah.
Mass-picked in some very large area. And those are typically what's called specialty coffees that you get in small places, but increasingly in supermarkets too,
mm-hmm.
And to distinguish them from the what we call supermarket coffees in cans.
Right.
Well, you know what? Let's take this line of conversation for a moment and run with it a little bit. Just so everyone knows, the way that coffee beans were generally grown is they're a commodity. They're traded as a commodity in the international market.
The second largest commodity in the world.
Right, like gold or silver or oil or cattle.
And so people are used to harvest these beans that are a commodity, and it doesn't matter where they're from. And there are some pretty interesting political implications of what happens because of that. Because of the governments and the places where they're and the poverty and the places where coffee is harvested.
Well, it does matter now where some of these things are from.
But with the commodity beans, because of the government, because of the political climate, they can really keep wages very much depressed, mm-hmm. almost to the point of slave labor.
Serfdom. Closest indentured servitude.
And now what you're finding is that it's not just the process like an industrial coffee is made. It's that when we go to individual coffee farms or farms, the Spanish word for farm is a finca, and get the beans specifically from a specific farm, that farm then can have a brand that says, okay, well, the coffee from my farm will be better than commodity coffee,
mm-hmm.
and it can then invest in the resources to preserve its land, to preserve its plants, to pay its workers, mm-hmm. because it can charge a little bit more. So that's what we're referring to that's going on there. But Sam, one of the things that happens that we look for selfishly as consumers that makes the whole thing work is that the coffee from these single estate, these specialty coffees, will have a better quality. What is it in the cup that we find that makes it a better quality, that makes that coffee taste better?
And it depends on the nature of the coffee, but typically you'll get, as with wine, you'll just get more complexity.
Uh-huh.
It won't
mm-hmm.
just be that straight, dull, caffeinated, hot beverage that jolts you in the morning. It will be...
Sam, sometimes I need a dull, straight, hot, caffeinated beverage that jolts me in the morning.
Then Mrs. Folgers is for you. By the way, your listeners might be interested to know that the cheaper coffee, there are actually two basic different kinds of coffee, Robusta and Arabica,
mm-hmm.
and the Robusta, the cheap stuff that goes into the cans in supermarkets, that actually has more caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
Than the more expensive stuff. So if you really want that caffeine jolt, get the cheap stuff.
So if you're looking
I'd rather have two cups of something good. Is that okay?
Sure.
If you're looking for the drug rush there. So we're talking about a greater level of complexity. And are there different for different regions, different countries, different places? Are there different like with wine? You know, some wines from some regions are more acidic, and some wines from some regions have more alcohol.
Sure.
Generally, does the same hold true for coffee?
Yeah, absolutely. For example. In, let's take Indonesia. The whole area of Indonesia is typically the coffee is grown at lower altitudes. And so typically the coffee there will be heavier, richer, earthier, but less acidic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let's go to a place like the Arabian Peninsula where you have a lot of high acid coffees. Now, one of the reasons for blending coffee as blending wine is you want to create a more balanced taste. And the most famous blend of coffee is called Mocha Java.
Mm-hmm.
And Mocha Java was created because the Mocha, which is from the Arabian Peninsula, Mocha is the port city in the Arabian Peninsula, is high acid but doesn't have as much body. They took the body coffee from Java, Indonesia, combined the two, and you've got this perfect balance of coffee.
I think one of the most interesting things about coffee in the specialty coffee market and is that, you know, it used to be you'd go in and order, say, I'll have a glass of red wine, mm-hmm. you know, and you used to, and you actually, you know, years ago you'd go in and say, yeah, I'll have the fish of the day, not even mm-hmm. knowing what the fish of the day was.
Mm-hmm.
But as we sort of grow up in America, you know, we now say, well, you know, what kind of fish is it? Is it a day boat halibut? Is it, you know, it's not just a generic white fish. And we don't go in and say, I'll have a glass of whatever the wine is. We say, what kind of wine do you have?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the interesting thing I see is people looking for individual types of coffee. And it's not just that there's, you know, there's okay coffee, better quality coffee, higher. It's not a contest. You know, mm-hmm. it's not like there's the 100-point coffee.
Different with different characteristics that each of us want. And we're not talking about a caramel macchiato.
Right.
Well, that actually has been the problem with places like Starbucks. I don't want to bash Starbucks.
Sure, let's. Why not?
They can handle it, man. They're not. They don't care. They really. They'll be all right.
Is that the quality of the coffee in so many of these drinks doesn't make any difference because it has so many layers of flavorings
right.
and milk.
Right.
That it doesn't make any difference.
It's just a coffee and caramel flavored milkshake.
Right.
So what's the difference?
Yeah.
So
exactly.
You know, we talked about fair trade coffee, and you
well, we didn't talk about it.
Well, we didn't talk about it.
Tell everybody what
else.
Let's talk about fair trade coffee.
Let's talk about fair trade coffee, Sam.
You know, it's interesting. There are two terms that you hear a lot of. One's called fair trade, and the other one's called shade grown coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Fair trade coffee simply means that the coffee that presumably that the coffee that you're buying. Comes from a farm or plantation where the workers are paid a fair wage.
Mm-hmm.
Shade-grown coffee is coffee that's grown in an area where there are shade trees and that the land is taken care of and it's not just sort of clear-cut and stripped.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is, and I learned this from Ted Lingle, who is the president of the Specialty Coffee Association, which is based in Long Beach, California, is he said, as long as you buy these high-quality estate coffees, doesn't have to be in the estate necessarily, but high-quality coffees, you are going to be taking care of both issues.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because when you buy high-quality coffee, you're buying it from somebody who takes care of his people.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and somebody who takes care of their property as well.
Right, and you're buying coffee that's grown in shaded areas because high-quality coffee has to have shade.
Mm-hmm. Right, and if you leave the trees, you protect the land.
Right.
And, you know,
the birds. And the people are worried about the birds, and the birds love the trees for nesting.
Right, mm-hmm. sure. Well, and the fact of the matter is if you raise anything as a commodity, it's the same as in American agribusiness. We talk about this all the time. If you raise it as a commodity, what it means is there's a worldwide race to the lowest possible price, and a lot of people get damaged along the way because the one guy who has to make money or the whole thing falls apart is the owner. And if he's got to shave money wherever he can and the price is the lowest point, the point is the lowest price, you have a problem. Sometimes when you pay a little bit more and you get a higher quality, you know, you can afford to pay people and take care of the land along the way.
Sure. The cheapest way is to go in and strip out an area of land, plant coffee, get it for 5 years, and if the land dies, the land dies. Oh, well, I'll move on to the next cheapest plot of land I can find.
Right, exactly. I mentioned briefly in my coffee story about Vietnam, and Vietnam, to the amazement of most people, is the second biggest coffee producer in the world, which is just astonishing to me. And they've gotten there like within 10 years just because they made this effort to do it. Unfortunately, they did it with the cheapest kind of coffee. And in doing so, not only did they lower the quality of the world's coffee, but they didn't do anything for the farmers in Vietnam.
Especially not long-term. It's not even in their enlightened long-term interest. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the history of coffee and things that you can do to make a great cup of coffee at home. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys. We're here talking with Sam DiGino, who's food columnist for the Wine Spectator magazine, a contributor to Cigar Aficionado and Women's Day, the New York Times. He's written a couple of books, and he has a great website called samcooks.com. Sam, we were talking about coffee before, and we were talking about how, you know, it can either be raised in a sustainable way, which is a way that we can keep getting coffee year after year after year, or in a way that sort of strips the land and eventually lowers the quality of coffee that you get, and also eventually reduces your ability to make coffee. And we have often said on the show that, you know, the ecology, a good ecological policy and good economic policy long-term are one and the same. You know, you can look at the ecology as a business. The question is the business a closeout sale, or do you want to stay in business, you know?
Sure.
So what happened in Vietnam? So they used the cheapest quality coffee, and they used the cheapest methods to make coffee. And so what's the long-term outlook for the Vietnamese economy as far as raising coffee?
Well, the problem is that the kind of coffee that they raise is the cheapest to sell, so they're not going to make a lot of money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony is that coffee is going into this mass-produced coffee, the supermarket coffee, and consumers are really not seeing a lot of benefit in the reduction of their coffee prices, which is kind of interesting.
Uh-huh.
As a result. So long-term, it's not good for Vietnam, and it's also not good for coffee regions outside of Vietnam, because what happens is a lot of the people who grow lower quality coffee, the Robusta coffee that goes into mass-produced coffee, also grow higher quality coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are outbid by Vietnam for their lower quality coffee, they may go out of business and not be able to produce the higher quality coffee
either. You can't only produce the great stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I like win-wins better than lose-loses.
Yeah.
Well, now, can I just ask you briefly, do you have recommendations where people can go? Now, we're going to send people to your website so they can find out places that you recommend to get great coffee and great coffee makers. What kind of coffee do you recommend that people are looking for retail? What are your favorites?
Well, I mean, online places?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned Pete's, although Pete's is now available in a lot of supermarkets. Pete's is now a public company.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Irony of ironies here for people who don't know the coffee business. The people who own Pete's started Starbucks.
Right, and then sold it.
Many years ago, and sold it to Howard Schultz, who's now the president. Anyway, Pete's certainly is one of them. Oren's Daily Roast, which is a wonderful outfit in New York City, makes very good coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Dallas, the company I mentioned earlier, which is a company in Queens, New York, does a very good job with coffee. Green Mountain does a good job with coffee. I'm sure I'm missing a few here, but those are a few to think about.
Now when our listeners call and we get this coffee, you may order it mail order or by the phone or over the internet, it gets roasted to order and sent out to you very quickly.
Yeah.
Now what kind of a shelf life do you think it has optimally for when they get it?
I would say within a couple weeks.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And you always suggest, of course, we suggest that you buy a whole bean and grind to order.
Right.
Now, I've heard that when you grind coffee, and I've heard some coffee experts tell me that when you grind coffee to order, you need to let it rest for a couple minutes to degas before you make your coffee. Is that true?
That would only be true if the coffee was just roasted within the last 36 to 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, what happens is when you roast coffee, it does emit some gases. And if you'll notice when you buy coffee mail order, and you can tell this if the coffee is fresh, they'll have a reverse gadget that allows the gas to come out of the coffee. But
doesn't
not
allow air in. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. And they do that because they know that it's going to emit this gas, and if they didn't do it, the package would blow up like a balloon.
Mm-hmm. I guess that'd be messy, Sam.
It would be messy.
I guess that is something you really don't want to have happen. So, when we do get this coffee at home, and when we do grind this coffee at home, where do I go besides your website to find out where to set my grinder level, how I make a great cup of coffee, what I need to do to make a great cup of coffee at home? Because you have some really great advice on your website about making sure the water's not too hot or not too cold. You know, what kind of machine to use? What kind of grind to use?
Well, there are five criteria. I mean, if you follow these five criteria, you don't mean much else.
Mm-hmm.
And one is to to grind the beans properly. Two is to make sure you have enough coffee. You know, one of the problems with brewing coffee is people don't use enough coffee.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The other thing is that you want to use good water, filtered water. It doesn't have to be, Evian, but it can be filtered water. Make sure the water's hot enough. That's probably the biggest problem.
Right, right.
Most coffee makers don't get the water hot enough to properly extract from the beans.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't realize that our restaurant coffee makers on a 220 line.
Right. Sam, you throw it on your website. I think this is helpful information to people. If your coffee maker is not a 1,200-watt minimum device,
right,
then your coffee's not hot enough.
Right. There are only about 3 coffee makers, at least the ones that I reviewed from my story, that did it. And information about how to get those is on the website.
And again, this is not about the coffee being hot, though that's important.
Right.
This is about the water being hot enough to extract the right melange of components from the beans.
Right.
So
if it's too warm, you're not going to get extraction. If it's too hot, you're going to burn the coffee.
Right. So those are the 5 areas of advice.
Well, the fifth one is to make sure you drink the coffee within 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You can't let that pot sit on that hot plate.
You don't like
First
to
of all,
sit
don't
on
use a
warmer.
Hot plate.
Right.
use a thermos.
Right.
And drink it within a half an hour.
Yeah, let me tell you guys again, our listeners, a little secret about what's happened in restaurants. You remember those little hot pots that they used to keep in the diners and things like that.
That Flo used to use at the Mel's
right,
diner,
yeah. where it would sit on a little hot plate. Good restaurants aren't doing that anymore. Now we're using thermoses and air pots,
which are much better because they don't continue to cook the coffee. Again, we're talking with Sam Gugino from SamCooks.com, columnist for the Wine Spectator magazine, contributor to Cigar Aficionado, Women's Day, and the New York Times, and we'll be talking with him more about coffee in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Sam Gugino, one of our favorite food journalists. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
Sam, this discussion that we've had on coffee, I think, has been really fascinating. And actually, there's a whole section to your article on the history of coffee and how this sort of came to be the second largest commodity traded in the world and maybe the most popular beverage in the world. Is it the most popular beverage in the world?
Probably, yeah.
And I would love to invite you back later in the week. Will you come and talk with us more about the history of coffee, which is absolutely fascinating?
Sure, I'd love to.
Super.
Terrific.
I want to mention one thing before I forget. In addition to the website, people can get a free online newsletter that I send out.
Mm-hmm.
And instructions on how to sign up for it are on the website.
You know, and I will tell you that I get this newsletter, and I've gotten it for years, and I find it to be one of the most informative and interesting things. And can I be honest with you, Sam?
Yes.
I read it, and I say, oh, let's do a story about that. So I plagiarize you all the time.
That's okay.
I steal my ideas from you. So we'll talk with you later in the week. Sam Gugino, thank you so much for taking
Sam,
the time to talk with us.
We'll talk
my
to you
pleasure,
later
Mark
this week.
Francis. Good to talk to you.
Take care.
Bye.
I need to bring your attention to something that's going on Saturday, June 25th. New Brunswick Cooks features an exclusive party on the roof of the Ferron Deck, which is across the street from the New Brunswick train station. There's an event called A Taste of New Brunswick. It's a dine-around from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. The open-air sampling of hors d'oeuvres and desserts from the city's restaurants is just a click away. Visit www.newbrunswick.com to purchase your $40 ticket. That's for many different restaurants. Or you can call 732-545-4849. Free parking is available at the Ferron Deck. That sounds like a lot of fun. Let's go to that one.
It does sound like fun.
Boy, that was a great article on coffee, don't you think?
Sure was.
A great article, a great show on coffee. He's a very intelligent fellow.
Yeah, one of the things, though, that we touched upon that I just wanted to go a little bit deeper in, you and I buy fresh roasted coffee all the time.
All the time.
And one of the things that our coffee roaster showed us, and we alluded to this just for a moment or two on degassing the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy fresh roasted coffee, for instance, if you come at the stage left and buy a pound of coffee, or you're going from one of these places that roast that day, you have to, after you grind the coffee, you've got to let it sit for about 20 minutes. Because what'll happen is the gas comes up off the coffee and it won't let the water in.
Right.
So, and actually our coffee guy, when the first week we opened, actually it was even before we opened, made a pot of coffee from these fresh roasted beans, and what you saw were dry spots
in the coffee from the bubbles
because the gas wouldn't let the water into.
And the other piece of advice that Sam gave is when you're using really good coffee, make sure you use enough coffee. When you use cheap coffee, if you use too much, you just get more bitterness.
It gets bitter.
If you use really good coffee, it just gets stronger, and it's better to have a cup of coffee that you say, you know, that's too strong. I'll dilute it with a little bit of hot water. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to take a weak cup of coffee and then infuse it. And we're going to have Sam back later in the week. He's going to be here on Wednesday. We're going to talk about the fascinating history of coffee. We're going to talk about percolating versus dripping versus espresso and so forth.
Maybe we'll even touch on a few other subjects.
I love coffee. Let's go have a cup of coffee, Mark. Shall we?
Sure.
I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.